Good evening and welcome to the show. This is Sports Takeover on RMU Radio, and we thank you for tuning in. Matt and Chris, as always, let's get to it. We are going to start in Major League Baseball, and the biggest news since the Red Sox won the World Series, Manny Machado is headed to San Diego. We finally have a signing, Chris, and I know how excited you are, so why don't you take us away?
It's the moment I've been waiting for all offseason. Two of the biggest names in free agency this year have been Bryce Harper and Manny Machado, and we can finally say one of them has landed after several weeks, several months of heartache, MLB app just giving us countless updates about nothing. Because nobody saw where Manny Machado was going to go up until really this past few weeks. So Machado did land with the San Diego Padres on a 10-year deal worth $300 million. All of it's guaranteed. He has a 5-year player option. So basically, he's going to test the Padres out for 5 years, see, okay, is this a team for real, or am I going to have to opt out of my contract? But either way, $300 million guaranteed for Machado, most lucrative deal in all of North American sports. Breaks both of A-Rod's contracts, any other contract. Huge deal for Machado, huge deal for the Padres. Good for baseball. Finally, this guy is signed.
Yeah, so this came out of nowhere. It was funny because when it happened, you and I had been together. We were talking, and you asked if somebody would sign in time for us to talk about it on the show, and I said, no, I don't think so. And you went to class, and literally within 10 minutes, Machado was signed. So it really came out of nowhere. I didn't think we'd be talking about this, but it is a gigantic contract, and he had a great year with the Orioles and with the Dodgers to earn himself this contract. I didn't know if he would get this contract just because of how long we've been waiting. I didn't know if there would be a team out there. The Padres are certainly one desperate enough to make this deal. It's interesting because I don't see the Padres as being a contender immediately, even with Machado. They do have a good farm system. I think they could be competitive at some point during his contract. They were 66-96 last season. That was good for dead last in the National League West. Their last winning season was 2010 when they went 90-72. So there's been some struggles in San Diego for sure. 2010s have been their worst decade as a franchise since the 70s, which was their first full decade as a franchise. So things really are not good in San Diego, but this is definitely something worth believing in if you're a Padres fan. 2015 offseason was one that also was supposed to bring some success with the likes of Matt Kemp, Will Myers, Justin Upton, and many more signing big contracts. Didn't work. They went 74-88, so hopefully this works better for them, but it's a record-setting deal. I think it's a good deal for the Padres. You have time to develop that farm system while Machado's there. He's 26 years old, so you're getting him at a good time. And you get him from the rival Dodgers, which is always nice, not only to take someone that a team you're competing against is trying to get themselves, but someone that they had before. So 25.5 games back is what they were of the Dodgers last year, who won the division. Certainly a lot of room to make up. Machado's not going to account for all of that by himself, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. You could even say that this deal came out of left field even. Aha, it's a baseball pun for
good one, Chris.
There.
Good one.
But no, I really think this is good for the Padres. You said you don't see them as contenders immediately. I, however, see them as sign of a Cubs, kind of an Astros team from a few years ago. So their farm system, according to MLB.com, ranks first amongst all 30 teams in Major League Baseball. In Major League Baseball's top 100 prospect list of 2019, they have 10 prospects on that list, including the number 2 overall prospect, Fernando Tatis Jr. So the Padres, while they've had horrid times in this decade, clearly now are finding what they need to do to get over the back of the division that they've been really finding themselves in these last few years. Yes, you mentioned a few years ago they made the big name signings, but none of them really as big as Machado. I mean, Matt Kemp, his best years were with the Dodgers. Anybody knew him signing a contract going forward would be his best years would be behind him. Machado, like you said, is 26, so at the end of his contract, he'll be 36. At the minimum, if he opts out for 5 years, 31. So you're catching him in the prime of his career. So when you have 5 years with Machado on your team, you really have all the opportunity, especially with all these great prospects. I mean, the Padres are going to be dangerous. And you said taking him away from the rival Dodgers, huge. Obviously, he was a big centerpiece for the Dodgers, helped get them to the World Series. Once again, not over the American League again, but that would not be the fault of Machado. Everybody else on the team had a role in it. But still, you get a guy away from the Dodgers who you can add to your team. You know, his war is going to bump you up. The Padres, I think, were projected about 75 wins going into it. After they signed him, they were up to 79 wins. Obviously, they're not going to be division contender, National League contenders immediately. but fixing him into a role at third base is great for them, especially considering that Petco Park, where the Padres play, is more of a pitcher park, and he is one of the best defensive third basemen in all of Major League Baseball. He's won Gold Gloves before with the Orioles. He can play shortstop. They won't need him there because that's where Tatis can play. But having him at third base as the cornerstone of this franchise moving forward, they will have him, Eric Hosmer, and Will Myers all signed through the next four seasons, in addition to all those prospects I've mentioned. So when you look at this huge core that they are building up, the Padres really have kind of success laid right in front of them. They just need to deliver on all these promises.
Yeah, you mentioned wins above replacement. It was 5.7 for him last season, 33.8 for his career. So good numbers there. I agree. I don't think they'll be competitive next year, not in terms of a championship, maybe a wild card spot, maybe a playoff spot. But you talked about those guys under contract, the farm system that they have, and Machado being in the prime of his career. If things go well, the Padres are set up for some success in the not-so-distant future, something that they are not accustomed to.
Now, the one big question remains, though, is the Padres don't really have that great pitching. I looked at their starting rotation last year. All their guys had above a 4.0 ERA. Not great. They still do have money to spend. Could you see them maybe bring in a Dallas Keuchel or even a Bryce Harper? I mean, the money is still there. I don't know that Harper would necessarily go to them or Keuchel, but still the fact that they have Machado there kind of could entice other players. Hey, they signed Machado. You know, they're willing to commit. Maybe I can try out my skills with them. Maybe they're the team that's the best fit for me now that they look like they're actually trying to move forward, as opposed to the past few years where it looked like they were just muddled between 65 and 75 wins.
Well, I don't think Harper's going to San Diego. I also didn't think Machado would either, so I guess nothing's off the table. Keuchel's an interesting point. I certainly think, if nothing else, Machado is an interesting player to watch for fans, an interesting player to potentially play with for free agents. So I do think it's a draw. I think you do get a benefit besides just Machado signing there.
Yeah, so either way, good for Padres, good for Major League Baseball. Manny Machado is signed. Hopefully by this point next week, we'll be talking about where Bryce Harper signed. But as of right now, Manny Machado being signed is the biggest news in Major League Baseball.
One down, one to go. Moving along, we're going to go to college basketball. We haven't talked as much about it as we may probably should have in recent weeks, so we're going to hit it this week. Teams to watch down the stretch here, Chris. We are approaching March Madness. Who you got?
There's a lot of really good elite teams. I'm going to stick my focus mostly in the top 10. There are 2 1-loss teams right now in college basketball. Number 6, Nevada, which has ranked themselves inside the top 10 throughout the duration of this whole season. And number 9, Houston, which nobody really thought they were going to be any kind of force coming into this season, but they only have one loss, so clearly they're a good team. Will definitely be at least a 3 seed going to the tournament if they can keep this up. But really, the big teams to look out for are the teams that you'd expect. The Duke, the Gonzaga, Virginia, Tennessee, all of those are my big teams I'm looking out for. All of them have 2 losses. Right now, Duke is number 1, Gonzaga 2, Virginia 3. Kentucky is at 4 because they just knocked off number 1 Tennessee last week. So all of these teams really have been very strong, very consistent throughout the season. Even if you go back to last year's tournament, they're all ranked very highly in the tournament. So for them to be still at a great position this year is very important for all these teams. And I really think they are the most dangerous right now.
Yeah, those top 3 are the big ones for me. Duke's been phenomenal this season. 58 out of 64 first place votes this week in the AP poll. So obviously they've kind of solidified themselves at the top. Their offense ranks 4th in college basketball, scoring 86.4 points per game, and they are 7-1 against top 25 teams, which is a great mark when those are the teams that you're going to be playing come March Madness, of course. So Duke, I think, is the favorite probably right now, and number 1 for a good reason. Gonzaga and Virginia are 2 teams that are there every year. Virginia last season, the top overall seed. Gonzaga, I believe, lost in the finals 2 years ago to UNC. So these are teams that are always up there, and Gonzaga's got the best offense in college basketball, 90.2 points per game, 12-0 in their conference. They are 1-2 against top 25 opponents, but obviously there's time for that to change, and you never know what happens come tournament time, and I still think Gonzaga's a very attractive team. Kentucky and Tennessee are interesting. They've kind of had some inconsistencies to their season. Kentucky's got a few more losses than some of the other teams. They're sitting at 4. The next team with that many losses is UNC at 8 with 5. So there's a little bit of difference there in terms of the losses, but they're not necessarily bad losses. They've lost to Duke, LSU, who's ranked in the top 15, Seton Hall and Alabama, not the greatest losses, but still, solid team. Tennessee kind of didn't show up last week against Kentucky, so that's disappointing to see for a team that's otherwise been pretty solid this year. But still, obviously, right there. The SEC is really a three-team race between Kentucky, Tennessee, and LSU, as I mentioned. So certainly a chance there for either of those teams to win their conference and get in that way.
Yeah, definitely. The SEC has never really been known as the strong college basketball conference. It's obviously a college football powerhouse, but in college basketball, it's mostly just Kentucky as the strong suit there. You know, sometimes you'll get in – Florida was last decade, but not so much this decade. Sometimes you'll get Alabama, Auburn thrown in there, but really it's mostly Kentucky. ACC is always between Duke, North Carolina, and Virginia. I mean, year in and year out, you can put those three against each other, you know, roll the dice, guess who's going to come out of it. This year, Duke looks to be the strong favorite. Virginia only has two losses this year, both of which came to Duke. Duke's two losses this year came to number two Gonzaga and unranked Syracuse. Every team kind of has an unranked loss come by the end of the season. We'll talk a little bit more about that later as a teaser for you all. But still, most of these teams find themselves losing to the best. Tennessee's only lost to Kansas and Kentucky, both in the top 10 at the point at which they lost. What's really interesting, though, is a conference that we aren't discussing as much, maybe one that we should, is the Big Ten. Michigan is clear dominant force in the Big Ten right now. Michigan State is also right up there. Michigan being the runner-up last year to Villanova in the finals. But they sit at three losses, but I just don't see them in the same level of play as these other teams that we're mentioning.
So one of my bold predictions earlier in the show was that Michigan would be the number one overall seed come March Madness. At the time, they didn't have as many losses as they do now. They've put up two duds in the last five games, including one to Penn State, who is dead last in the Big Ten.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
That's a bad loss. And Michigan State's kind of in the same boat, and we have these two in a quick pick later, and we'll talk about it a little bit at that point too. But Michigan State has lost three of their last six. So these are two teams that don't look like they want to be in the top 10 right now, but that still have the potential to be there. I'm still in on Michigan. They surprised me last year, one of the last undefeated teams this year. So I'm still in on them, but looking at them and what they've done recently compared to that of the top teams, it's tough to say that they are the favorites right now, but certainly playing good basketball going into the tournament, I think those are two teams that you got to watch out for.
The thing about the Big Ten in college basketball right now reminds me a lot of the Pac-12 in this past college football season. They've had very competitive teams that have been right up there. In the Pac-12, it was Washington State, neither of which made the playoff. In the Big Ten basketball right now, it's Michigan and Michigan State. Then there's about three or four different teams that are ranked between 15th and 25th, and they've been shuffling all around. None of them are bad. None of them are fantastic. You'll see some fives, some six, some seven seeds out of these guys, but none of them really seem to be teams that are going to make a run, necessarily teams that if you beat them, you're set for the future. Like how, you know, Duke beating Virginia twice obviously is monumental for them. If Michigan is able to beat Iowa and Maryland, I mean, they're good wins to have, but they're not going to set you over the edge.
Nothing earth-shattering.
And one of the big things about tournaments is you want to come in going hot. We've seen it year in and year out. Sometimes teams just get their streak in their conference tournament and ride their wave all the way through. Well, with Michigan and Michigan State dropping so many games recently, now is not the time to get cold. Whenever there's going to be more competitive teams like the ones we mentioned in the ACC, you know, Duke, North Carolina, Virginia, all those teams are going to be hot. You're probably going to have to face one of those teams somewhere along your tournament path. So you need to focus on the wins right now. And if you're Michigan, you can't lose to last place in the conference, Penn State. You just can't. That's an inexcusable loss. There's no way you can allow for it if you want to see yourself as a title contender.
No, I totally agree. They certainly have work to do. Their schedule is not as impressive as some of those ACC teams that have to play each other. A couple other teams that we haven't touched on a whole lot. Number 8, UNC, is one that maybe at five losses isn't having as good a season as they have from time to time, but I certainly think that they're still a team to watch out for. A couple wild cards outside of the top 10. Texas Tech is number 14. Virginia Tech is number 20. Both have top 10 defenses. So that's something that they can hang their hats on and something that could come into play come tournament time. And again, those are teams that if they're playing well at the right time, some stellar defense mixed with some timely offense could prove to be effective for those teams. And I believe Texas Tech was a 3 seed in the tournament last year. So some reasonable experience there for those two teams as well. Something just to watch out for as well.
Yeah, one team I'm really looking forward to is Buffalo. The Buffalo Bulls currently sit at 25th with only 3 losses, one of which being to Marquette, who finds themselves, I believe, ranked 9th right now in the poll.
11th.
Okay, so, you know, they're on the rise, though. Marquette wasn't ranked going into this season. So Buffalo only has 3 losses, one to Marquette, which was a close game, and the other 2 losses they have been by a combined 6 points. So, you know, a 3-pointer goes in here or there. Buffalo is a 1-loss team in the top 10 with the likes of Houston and Nevada. Once again, aren't the team that you're going to be talking about throughout the whole season as the strong contender, but don't be afraid of them. You mentioned Texas Tech. We're not really talking about Kansas as much. Kansas is kind of having an off year.
It's another one, yeah.
As far as they're concerned, they were in the top five earlier in the season. I believe number one even at some point, but they've had multiple losses. I don't even believe they sit at first in their conference right now. I believe they are tied with Kansas State. So Kansas is typically a team you'll see as a 1-2 or a 3 seed, but this year they might be finding themselves more as an outsider looking in. Another thing I like about Duke is right now in the NBA mock draft, they have three projected top 10 draft picks, Matt. Three, Cam Reddish, Zion Williamson, and RJ Barrett, all are projected to go in the top 10. These guys are going to compete at the NBA level next year, and they're doing it this year at college at incredible levels. Roy Williams, the coach for UNC, he's coached there about 30 or 40 years, said that Zion Williamson is the most dominant, most complete college basketball player he's ever seen. This is the same guy that coached Michael Jordan. So Duke is definitely a very scary team.
Duke's for real. Duke is probably hands down the favorite right now until someone else proves otherwise. Jumping back to Kansas real quick, they are sitting at 20-6 overall. That's 12th in the country, 9-4 in the conference. Texas Tech is also 9-4 in the conference. They sit at 21-5 overall. Kansas State 10-3 in the conference, 20-6 overall. So kind of a jumbled mess up at the top of that conference. Certainly Kansas can make up that ground though.
Yeah, definitely. So it'll be very interesting to see how these conference tournaments go on as the season progresses. But right now, there are a clear set of elites in college basketball and some teams on the outside looking in.
Moving into the National Hockey League, we are less than a week away from the trade deadline, and there have been some early trades and some other storylines coming in. So as we approach the deadline, Chris, what are you looking at? What are the hot topics in the NHL?
Well, first, we're going to start with a trade that actually did happen last week. It was a goalie trade, an interesting one in my opinion. So Edmonton sent Cam Talbot to the Philadelphia Flyers in exchange for Anthony Stolarz. Edmonton is out of it. They are not going to compete this year. Philadelphia had been out of it most of the season until a recent winning stretch behind rookie Carter Hart has really propelled them back to kind of in a wild card spot. They currently sit a few points out, but getting this goalie help with Cam Talbot as the backup to Hart going down the stretch really is good for the Flyers. We talked about it when they were firing their coach and GM earlier in the year that goalie has been the problem for the Flyers for years. For them to find Hart and now to get Talbot, Talbot is a proven winner. Both on the same team, really good for them. I like this move a lot.
Talbot's struggling a lot this year, so I think the change of scenery will be good for him. Stolarz is a young kid who, with Hart playing well now, kind of pushes Stolarz back a little bit for as long as he's in Philadelphia. Going into Edmonton, I don't know what their plan is with him, with Koskinen having taken over as the starter.
And signing an extension a few weeks back, too.
That's right. So interesting there for Stolarz, but maybe the fresh start he's looking for as a 25-year-old. Neither of them have fantastic numbers this season, so I think if nothing else, the change of scenery is good for them. It probably suits the teams better that they're going to. I think, like you said, Talbot fitting that backup role, Stolarz possibly competing for a starter's job. I think it's a good move for the players, and I think it's a solid move for the teams as well. Another trade of some note, Ryan Spooner was sent to the Vancouver Canucks for Sam Gagne, who went back to Edmonton. Five-time 40-point scorer with the Oilers is Gagne. Don't know that he'll make a huge difference. Neither one of them have played much of a role yet this season. Spooner actually has played for two teams already, the Rangers and the Oilers, so he's on to number three. Not a huge trade, straight up one for one, just some depth players there, nothing too major.
Yeah, for as close as the West is, the Canucks adding Spooner, I guess, is good for them. I mean, I don't see the Canucks as a playoff team, but currently as a standing sit, they are just as much of a playoff team as half the teams in the Western Conference
are. So
I guess this is good for them. Sam Gagne going back to the Oilers, I mean, he's okay, I guess. You know, he's not going to be a 40-goal scorer for you or anything. You know, I guess he'll be a good third or fourth line center. But once again, I don't know what the Oilers' direction moving forward really is. You have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl both having excellent seasons. And then there's the rest down the line. It's the same misery that they found themselves in 10 years ago. We thought maybe 2 years ago after they made a good playoff run that, yes, okay, Edmonton finally found their stretch. You know, this is who they are. They're going to be good going forward. Last year they took a step back, and this year they fell right down the steps. I mean, it's just a mess for them. Canucks are definitely doing very well this year. They have Rookie of the Year candidate in Elias Pettersson. He's having a fantastic year. So they could find themselves in a playoff spot. Wouldn't necessarily see them there myself, but maybe next year they can find themselves better in that position. And I believe there was another trade earlier too, Matt, wasn't there?
Yeah, so I don't know that this one is actually official, but it has been reported.
I believe as of 10 p.m. tonight it will be.
There you go. Charlie Coyle is headed to the Boston Bruins for Ryan Donato in a fifth-round pick. That's headed to Minnesota. He would probably potentially be the third line center in Boston behind David Krejci and Patrice Bergeron. He's under contract till next season. Cap hit is below four for a young guy. Had some success. Not a great season, but Minnesota's not having a great season themselves. I think it's a good move for Boston. I think it makes Boston scarier in the Eastern Conference. For Minnesota, I don't understand what's happening. It's a team that is, I believe, the oldest team in the National Hockey League, a team that has one win in their last 10 games, a team that can't find the back of the net, they can't skate with these young, fast teams that are throughout the league. I don't think trading Charlie Coyle is the answer when a guy like Eric Staal could potentially have some value somewhere else. And that's not to say that they're not done making moves, and I certainly think that they should still be making moves. I'm just not sure that this was the place to start for them, and I'm also not sure that Donato in a fifth is necessarily the return that I would want if I was trading Charlie Coyle and trying to get my team going in a new direction, but that's what they've done.
No, Minnesota must have been talking to Edmonton about how to make trades, because neither this trade doesn't really make a lot of sense for me either. Minnesota is in a playoff spot right now. They currently, I believe, are the top wild card in the West. But for any hockey fan out there that has followed the Western Conference this year, you know that Minnesota will not be a competitive team come the playoffs. They might win a series, maybe, but I would doubt it. They are most likely to be a one-and-done team. Like you said, they're one of the oldest in the NHL. Them and the Kings are right up there. Kings, obviously, are bad. Minnesota, eh. They have gone through coaches. They just never had the steady algorithm to get it done. They've always been right there, but never been able to put themselves over the edge. Getting rid of Charlie Coyle won't help at all. He is a very good young center for them. Good for Boston to get him. I think it's great for them. They must have a thing for right-handed centermen. You now got Bergeron, Krejci, and Coyle right down the middle, all three righties. I like that a lot. That's some fun stuff there. But Boston really has to compete with Toronto and Tampa. Those three teams, I think, are the strongest three teams right now in the Eastern Conference, all of which preside in the Atlantic Division. So only one of those three teams is going to end up making the conference finals. So Boston really needs to compete. Last year, it was a tough first round against Toronto. They barely came out on top, but then they just couldn't get it done come Tampa. So I think adding the depth down the center really is big for them. And only giving up Donato in a fifth for Charlie Coyle is not a bad return at all. When you see the Penguins gave up so much last year for Derek Brassard in a trade that didn't work, for them to only give up essentially two players for one player that will fit into your third line center role right now immediately and do well at it, I think is good for Boston immensely.
I think it's a good trade for Boston as well. And while we're on the topic of the Atlantic Division, we'll move away from the trades that have happened so far and move to a team that probably doesn't need to make any trades, the Tampa Bay Lightning, having a phenomenal season at 46-11-4, 96 points, miles ahead of everybody else in the National Hockey League. Is it cup or bust, Chris?
It has to be. This is the best hockey team I have ever seen in my 20 years of life. Obviously, the Red Wings have had good teams, some of which came before I was born, but for as long as I've been a fan of hockey, this Tampa team is just insane. Currently, they're on pace to get 129 points in the regular season. That is ridiculous. They have a plus 80 goal differential. I don't see that going down anytime soon. Whenever Nikita Kucherov puts up multiple four-point nights in a row, oh, and speaking of Kucherov, he currently sits at a mere 99 points, which is putting him on pace to get 130 by the end of the season. Still, just it's incredible. Their goalies are even great, too. Andrei Vasilevskiy, 26-7-4. He's tied for the league lead in save percentage. Oh, well, how's their backup doing? You know, you need a good backup. Well, Louis Dominguez, 18-4, so clearly they have the right formula there. And you said it whenever you start to introduce this topic, Tampa doesn't need to make any trades at all. They are strong in the center, on the wings, defensively, goaltending-wise. Currently in the National League point standings, Nikita Kucherov sits at first, Braden Point's fourth, and Steven Stamkos is eighth. So they got three guys in the top eight in points. They are just insane. I haven't seen a team that has been so dominant throughout the whole season, too. There's really never been a point where they've stepped back either.
Yeah, and as a team, they have the top power play in the NHL, second best penalty kill. They have 10 more wins than any other team, and they have the best point percentage at 787. The next closest is Calgary at 669. So they're really, it's teams that they wish they can make the playoffs, teams in a playoff position, and Tampa. They're in their own little world. And you talked about Nikita Kucherov on pace for 130. The last time that happened was 1996 when Mario Lemieux put up 161. No one else has done it. Other benchmarks, I guess, that he could be looking at, Crosby put up 120 in 2007, Joe Thornton 125 in 06, and then you're really going back, Jaromir Jagr put up 121 in 2001, 127 in 1999. So these are the highest point scores that we've seen in the last 20 years or so, and Kucherov is on pace to blow them out of the water too. And at 70 assists, he's leading the league. It's just incredible stuff by the team and incredible stuff by him.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to pose a question to you. I'll give some facts for you to make your decision, but is Nikita Kucherov the best player in the NHL right now? It's kind of been talked about. Is it Crosby or is it McDavid for like the last few years since McDavid's been in it? But over the last three seasons, including this year, the top 5 point earners in the National Hockey League, Connor McDavid, first with 291, Kucherov is second with 284, Patrick Kane is third with 255, Sidney Crosby is fourth with 251, and Brad Marchand is fifth with 240. So when you talk about, you know, the best players in the league, McDavid obviously is right up there, rightfully so. Crosby most certainly as well with being fourth. Kane is kind of taking a step back now that he's come out of the limelight from the Blackhawks. But people really, I don't think, give Nikita Kucherov enough credit for what he's doing. He's putting up insane numbers each of these last three seasons, and he doesn't look like he's going to slow down either.
No, you're right. He's absolutely in the conversation. And I think to make that decision, I would have to see a couple more things. I think it's really tough, but I think it's hard to argue that he would be outside of the top four. Just thinking off the top of my head, I don't know that there's anybody I could put in the top four that isn't named Crosby, McDavid, Kucherov, and Kane. Probably. And they're obviously in different circumstances regarding the overall play of the team, who they get to play with, whether it be on the power play, whether it be 5-on-5. So certainly some different circumstances there. But he's absolutely in the conversation, no doubt.
Yeah, and it's just, it's so hard for me to see Tampa Bay not winning the Cup this year. They are clearly going to be the President's Trophy winner. They sit 18 points above the next closest team. However, the last time the President's Trophy winner won the Cup was in 2012-13 season with the Chicago Blackhawks. Each of the last four seasons, a team hasn't even made the Stanley Cup final, let alone won the Stanley Cup as their President's Trophy winner. So kind of a curse for Tampa Bay maybe, but I don't think that they'll let that stigma hold them back at all.
They can't. They are in the Cup final in 2015, Eastern Conference final in 16 and 18. This team has done everything that they can possibly do. Assuming they win the President's Trophy this year, they will have done everything that they could possibly do other than actually winning the Stanley Cup. And with the performance that these guys are putting on, you talked about the 129 points that they're on pace for, the highest point total any team has ever put together in NHL history was the Canadiens put up 132. So that 129 really speaks volumes. Not only will it blow everybody out of the water this year, it's blowing most teams out of the water all time. So for me, they have to win the Cup. Not saying that they're definitely going to. Anything can happen. But for this season to not be a disappointment, they have to win the Stanley Cup.
If you're a Tampa Bay fan right now, it is Stanley Cup or bust.
One more NHL thing here to discuss. Artemi Panarin, we talked about the trade deadline. He is a player who has expressed the desire to test free agency come the end of the year. 27-year-old. 24 goals, 43 assists on the season, plus 14. He's got about a point per game throughout his career. Currently playing for the Blue Jackets. Do you think he moves?
I don't know that he will move. I think that the Blue Jackets should move him. If you look at the Blue Jackets, they're a team that does not know how to win in the playoffs, period. They have people like John Tortorella. I don't think he's a very good coach at all. I think he is one of the worst coaches in the league. I think that he should not have a job with the Columbus Blue Jackets anymore. Yet because the skill that the Blue Jackets have on the ice, he manages to keep his job still. Panarin will not re-sign with the Blue Jackets. It would not make sense for him to re-sign with them. They do not look like they have the right pieces moving forward when you still have to compete with Pittsburgh, Washington, and suddenly the New York Islanders in the Metropolitan Division. So while they have good regular seasons, I don't think they're a team that you can really build around. Obviously, Panarin could be a player you could build around, but because I don't think the Blue Jackets have the right pieces moving forward, I don't think that they should keep him. They should try to see what the biggest return on value can get is. And honestly, any team in the East or the West that's looking to make a run, they need Artemi Panarin on their team. One of the best right wingers, you mentioned it, 24 goals, 43 assists. He is an elite goal scorer. He will most certainly help your team down the stretch. It's just a matter of whether John Tortorella and the Blue Jackets are willing to part ways with him or not.
So I'm just going to leave it at this. I think this is a good team. And this is a team that could make a run if they're playing well enough. It's a team that will not win the Stanley Cup because John Tortorella is the coach. John Tortorella was a good coach in the early 2000s when the style of play was punch the other team in the face and run them over and score if you get the chance to. That's not how we play hockey anymore. You're looking at speed and skill. John Tortorella still thinks it's 2007, and the Blue Jackets will not win a Stanley Cup for as long as he's the coach. That's something I've said for a long time. It's something I believe almost more than anything else, I think, in the NHL. The Blue Jackets will not win a cup with John Tortorella, which means that they will not win this year, which means that trading Artemi Panarin is the right move. Will they do it? I don't think so, because I think that they think they can win right now. They're wrong. They have the wrong coach. Panarin should be traded. We'll see what happens.
Boston, wait till the deadline. Hopefully some more zesty trades happen in the following days. One more little nugget attached to the NHL kind of branches the NHL and football. So Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon recently invested $250 million in the new upstart Alliance of American Football League. The reason he did this was because that the Alliance was not really going to meet their payroll after their first week. What do you make of this, Matt?
So the one thing I will say for the Alliance is obviously they're a startup. Every startup struggles financially at some point. Thankfully for them, they're succeeding in other ways. People are watching, people are talking about them, and they seem to be popular through their first 2 weeks. Obviously, they need the money, and I think it's fantastic that he made this move for them. Had they been in a situation where they weren't popular and struggling financially, I think they'd be in big trouble, seeing as they now have $250 million that they didn't before and people like them early on. I think they're going to be okay. I think we could potentially see a team coming to Raleigh in the near future after this.
Perfectly sets it up.
Which would be absolutely fine. Expansion is something on their radar. But I don't think the AAF is in trouble. I think they would have been without this, but this is huge. I think it's a good investment for him. It's great for the AAF. I think it's good for everyone.
Yeah, I think the difference between this and the XFL from several years ago is that the reason that league folded after one season was because people did not see it as a league moving forward. People see the AAF as a capable league moving forward, especially when you have rich, wealthy owners such as Tom Dundon able to do such things. Giving $250 million says, okay, I'm investing in you. I understand that you will be a real reasonable league moving forward. Let's get it done. So I like it a lot. Could have been bad. Thankfully, he saved the day.
Agreed.
All right, right now we're going to take a quick break, but coming up, we have some more Top Takeover and some more Uncorked for you, some of the fan favorite segments. So please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris. We are going to move into Top Takeover, our ranking segment. And the topic tonight is going to be the top five NHL trades of all time. Very fitting as we are approaching the deadline. So I will lead it off. At number five, Dominik Hasek to the Buffalo Sabres. He went over for a goaltender from the Sabres and a fourth round pick. Went to Chicago. The goaltender that they traded never played for them, never played for Chicago. And, of course, a fourth-round pick is not a big deal when the guy that you get back plays nine seasons, wins six Vezina trophies as the top goaltender in the National Hockey League, a two-time MVP, no cups, unfortunately. They did get to one final, but he's on the list as a top goaltender of all time. And this trade, when you only have to give up a mid-round pick, a goalie that never played for you, and it obviously didn't work out very well for the Blackhawks, having Hasek changes the game for the Sabres, even though they don't win a cup. And this trade would be higher on my list if they did win a cup. It's still a fantastic trade. It's a guy who had, and he had more success than that in his career. That was just what he did in Buffalo. So fan favorites, a guy who kind of put Buffalo on the map. I think that's a fantastic trade for them, for what they gave up and for what they got back.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't include him on that list just because, like you said, he didn't actually bring them cup success. One of the big things I looked forward to when making my list was, did these guys help bring their team a cup? Obviously, six Veznas, MVPs, a cup finals appearance is fantastic, but just wasn't that little bit to get him over the edge. Dominik Hasek, though, definitely a top five goaltender of all time. Could make an argument for number one, though, but definitely in the top five. Good trade. I like it. At my number five, I'm going to put the Mark Messier trade when he was sent to the Rangers in exchange for Louis DeBrusque, Bernie Nichols, and Steven Rice, who went to Edmonton. This will be one on a list of many trades in which Edmonton had a fire sale of all the good players on their team. But with the Rangers, Mark Messier was able to win the MVP in the 91-92 season and win a Stanley Cup in the 93-94 season. He's heralded as one of the best players to have ever played for the Rangers in all of their storied history, brought them the cup success in the 90s, obviously the MVP in the season that the Penguins were able to knock them off in the playoffs. Had they not, could have possibly seen two cups in his career. But needless to say, though, getting Mark Messier in return for three players, which I had not heard of, and really when I looked at their stats, were nothing magnificent either, from Edmonton, huge for the Rangers, really is the main piece that got them that cup, so I'm going to put him at number five on my list.
I'll have more on that in a bit. In the meantime, my number four trade is Ron Francis and Ulf Samuelsson to the Pittsburgh Penguins. They come over with Grant Jennings in exchange for John Cullen, Zarly Zalapsky, and Jeff Parker. They get shipped to Hartford. These guys filled the holes that the Penguins needed filled the best. Francis was able to slot in at the number two center behind Lemieux. Samuelsson provided the shutdown defenseman that they didn't have. And you talk about cup success. It led to the first two Stanley Cups in Penguins history in 91 and 92, a President's Trophy in 1993. Really no lasting impact for Hartford in this trade, but for the Penguins, it brought immediate success. And for that to be them getting over the hurdle for the first time in their franchise's history puts this trade on my list.
Yeah, it's definitely a good one, especially some great names there. Zarly Zalapsky, I love that name.
Yeah, how about that one, huh?
But John Cullen was definitely a good player for the Penguins. He was, I believe, a 40-goal scorer even one season with them. So he was a big piece that had to be moved. But sometimes you got to make the big moves in order to get the big results. Penguins certainly saw it. Another Penguin trade actually makes my list at number four. Happened a little bit before yours. It was, once again, coming from Edmonton, the Penguins received Paul Coffey, Dave Hunter, Wayne Van Dorp in exchange for Dave Hannon, Chris Joseph, Mo Mantha, and Craig Simpson. Once again, a bunch of guys I had never heard of, but the one that sticks out, and rightfully so, is Paul Coffey. Had some great Norris campaigns with Edmonton in the 80s, won a few cups with them, makes the move to the Penguins, helps lead them to their first Stanley Cup. Up until this season, he had been the Penguins' leader in goals for the team. He has had two 100-point seasons with the Penguins in his career. Considered the best defenseman in Penguins history, really was a cornerstone for the franchise in the 90s. So great for him. Good trade for the Penguins. Number four on my list.
Yeah, very key piece to the puzzle for the Penguins in those Stanley Cup endeavors in the 90s. My number three trade is one that you've already talked about. It's Mark Messier to the Rangers. I won't put the details out there again as you already did that, but he led the Rangers to the first President's Trophy in their franchise's history, and he won the first cup in New York since 1940, which was the longest drought in NHL history. So for one of the most storied franchises in the NHL, they had struggled for a long time. Messier comes over, guarantees the Stanley Cup, and delivers on the Stanley Cup. Great player to have in New York. He brought the results with him. He's my number three.
It seems like mid-90s success is one of the key points of ours, because at my number three, I also have another mid-90s trade. It was with Hartford once again, once seemingly following the same footsteps that Edmonton did in sending away really good players. Detroit received Brendan Shanahan from Hartford in exchange for Paul Coffey, Keith Primeau, and a first rounder. Now, this was a big trade because, obviously, I talked about how good Paul Coffey was for the Edmonton and the Penguins, so he was no minor detail. Keith Primeau was a very good forward, and obviously a first rounder is huge. But with Brendan Shanahan, Detroit got that depth, that grit that they needed in order to win three Stanley Cups. And he was on a part of that team for all three of those, including back-to-back at the end of the 90s. He was a physical presence on the ice, kind of what they needed to get past Colorado, which was physical at that time. There was a great rivalry in the 90s between those two teams. Unfortunately, like I said, not alive at that point. Wasn't able to see it myself, but that doesn't mean it didn't exist. It was great. Shanahan was very important for them. Definitely a big piece in getting those three Stanley Cups, so he ranks at number three for me.
So I'll go to the other side of that rivalry with my number two trade, and it's going to be Patrick Waugh to the Colorado Avalanche. I talked about Hasek earlier. Drew a blank on that name completely. Dominic Hasek is one of the top goalies ever. Patrick Waugh is up there in that conversation as well. And he gets shipped to Colorado, who, again, was kind of in that situation where they were there but couldn't quite get there. Patrick Waugh got them there. They also acquired Montreal's captain, Mike Keane, at that time for a few pieces that didn't really amount to much for Montreal. Patrick Waugh was a cup champion and a Conn Smythe two times with Montreal and finishes the winningest goalie in NHL history. So that gives you the idea of what kind of player Colorado was acquiring here. And he got Colorado over the hump, won another Conn Smythe there, won two Stanley Cups there, put Colorado on the map. Montreal hasn't been to a final since. So not only did he have a big impact on Colorado, he had a big impact on Montreal. And that just speaks volumes about how huge this trade was for the Avalanche.
Yeah, definitely. I said Hasek could be considered the best goalie of all time, top five. Patrick Waugh is right up there with him. I'd say he's definitely a top three goalie of all time, not even top five. Huge for the Montreal Canadiens, huge for Colorado. Another goalie trade, which I actually didn't know about until I started to look up some of these past trades, but once I saw this one, it had to make my list, occurred back in the 1970s for the Philadelphia Flyers. So Philadelphia received goaltender Bernie Perron and a second rounder in exchange for Doug Favell and a first rounder to Toronto. Now, interestingly enough, Perron was with Philadelphia earlier in the 70s, at the beginning of the 70s, and got sent to Toronto. Didn't end up really wanting to play for Toronto, didn't report to them, ended up playing in the World Hockey Association for one season before he decided that Toronto's not right for me, shipped me back to Philly. So he got shipped back to Philly, and boy, did he make an impact with them. He won back-to-back Vezinas and back-to-back Conn Smythes as the Flyers won two consecutive Stanley Cups in his two seasons back. And oh, by the way, that's the last time the Flyers have won a Stanley Cup. So if they want to be able to get over the hump once again, goalies have been their problem. They must need to call up Bernie Perron, because he is one of the best players to ever play in their organization. Both of those seasons, too, finished in the top five in MVP voting. Definitely an overlooked trade in all the grand scheme of trades.
Yeah, no, that's a really good one. Obviously, the only success, real success that the Flyers have had, thanks to him. So that's a good one to have on the list. My number one is, I think, what could be a lot of people's number one, Wayne Gretzky to the Los Angeles Kings from the Edmonton Oilers. Wayne Gretzky is arguably the best player to have ever played the game, so the fact that he was traded is mind-boggling to me. He goes over with Marty McSorley, who is his bruiser, kind of the guy that played with Gretzky through most of his career, to kind of protect him, and Mike Krushelnicki, who I hope I'm saying
more
that right.
Good names.
Don't know who he is. But obviously Gretzky's the major piece there. To Los Angeles, from Los Angeles to Edmonton, Jimmy Carson, Martin Jelinas, three first-round picks and $15 million. So quite the return, but Gretzky going there is just, I don't think it can be matched. The Oilers had won four cups in 5 years with Gretzky in his prime. They won another one after. Gretzky was not able to win a cup in Los Angeles, but he did get them to the finals in 1993. It's just the impact that he had in hockey in California is the reason that I have this trade at number one. Obviously, he wasn't able to bring a cup to Los Angeles, but he put hockey on the map in a place where hockey wasn't necessarily a popular sport. Even in the U.S., to have the greatest player shift from Canada to the United States is absolutely huge for hockey in America. It was a fantastic way to grow the game. It just obviously having the greatest player in the world on your team is going to make your team better. It's going to make a difference. It's going to draw people in. But what it did for hockey in California, in the United States, is why, for me, this trade has to be number one.
So it seems like we talked about earlier, Edmonton doesn't really know how to make trades. We've had them now three times on each of our lists not knowing how to make trades. So clearly they have not learned their lesson at all in the last 25 years. My number one is one that you mentioned before, and that is Patrick Waugh. In my opinion, he is the best goaltender of all time. There's no way to deny it. He won, like you said, two Stanley Cups with Colorado, their first two, and won one Conn Smythe with them. The fact that he got traded, I actually read a story about it when doing the research, was that he was left in an 11-1 game in which he gave up 9 goals as kind of a way for him to be humiliated by the coach of sorts. I don't know why you'd really want to humiliate a guy that has brought so much success to your franchise, but hey, you know, go ahead, Montreal. I guess if that's your prerogative, do it. Clearly, it hasn't worked. And the GM that traded him had only been GM for not even 2 months at the time. So clearly, nobody in the Montreal organization was in a position to be moving arguably the best goaltender of all time. Yet, for whatever foolish reason, they decided to move him. Great for Colorado jumping on that bandwagon. They made a trade a little bit earlier in the 90s for Peter Forsberg as well. Those two guys, monumental in Avalanche success, but most importantly to me, Patrick Waugh is number one trade of all time.
Yeah, I came across that story too, and it's just mind-boggling that that's how things went down for him in Montreal, a guy who had had success there. Certainly a good trade for Colorado, not so much for the Canadiens. But that's Top Takeover. Those are our top five trades of all time. We'll see what comes about in the next week and what we have to discuss next week. Perhaps we'll have a trade that could also fit on this list. Time will tell.
I would guess not.
In the meantime, we'll go to another segment that we recently put into the show, Uncorked, where we're going to dive deep into an issue, and this one is going to be college basketball, as we talked about a little bit earlier, and we're going to find out what is more important when ranking teams in college basketball. Is it ranked wins, or is it unranked losses? Chris, go ahead.
Okay, so in doing this, I looked at the 2018, 17, and 16 March Madness, specifically the one seeds, kind of seeing what were their records, what were their records against top 25, how many unranked losses did they have. So starting with 2018, among the four number one seeds, the average record was 29.5 losses. Not bad. 2017, it was 29.5 and 3.75 losses. In 2016 was 28 wins and 5.75 losses. So pretty much if you can get yourself 29 wins, about 29-5, you're going to be a one seed. So that's the path to success that teams need to carve out for themselves. However, the way in which you get to that 29-5 doesn't necessarily need to be very explicit. You can mix in top 25 wins. You can have unranked losses. It doesn't really seem like the committee cares extraordinarily about it. In these last 3 years, among all 12 of these number one seeds, only one has had more than six, or had two have had at least five unranked losses. That was in 2016 when 26-7 Virginia had five unranked losses, and 28-6 Oregon actually had all six of their losses being unranked. So for the most part, you aren't going to find teams that have unranked losses except for in 2016. So I guess from that perspective, you could kind of say that the top 25 is more important, but I know that you have more to dive into this with, so go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. So we always hype up the ranked matchups, and rightfully so. Those are the teams that everybody wants to see. And I would agree that the committee seems to put more emphasis on ranked wins. And whether or not that's the case is what we're trying to figure out here. I also looked at the last three March Madness brackets. I looked at the one seeds as well as the two seeds and any other team that wasn't a one or two that would have made the finals. So starting with 2018, we'll look at this one just a little bit closer. There were four teams of the ones, twos, and finalists that made it to the Elite Eight or farther, five teams that failed to do so. So of the eight teams of the four teams that got to the Elite Eight or farther, 19 ranked wins between those teams, 16 unranked losses. That's an average of 4.75 ranked wins throughout the season and four losses for a top seed that has some success in the tournament. For the other five teams that fit that criteria that didn't have that much success, they also had 19 ranked wins, of course, divided between one extra team, 12 unranked losses. So that's 3.8 wins, ranked wins per team, and 2.4 unranked losses for these teams that had expectations that they didn't meet. So very interesting, I think, to see that while ranked wins are important, unranked losses are also more frequent for these teams. So I dove into the 2017 and the 2016 bracket as well. And I won't go into all the details. What I will say is that of the ones and the twos, the championship teams came out of those. So there were no additional teams, which says that maybe they're doing something right here and how we're ranking them, where we've had finalists come in as a one seed or a two seed the majority of the time. But looking at it overall, there were 10 teams that made it to the Elite Eight or farther, 59 ranked wins between them, 24 unranked losses. This is combining 17 and 16 together. So per team, that's 5.9 ranked wins throughout the regular season and 2.4 unranked losses. For the six teams that failed to make it past the Sweet 16, 32 ranked wins, 13 unranked losses. That's 5.3 wins, 0.8 losses, which is a really low number that surprised me a lot. And kind of what I gathered from this is that we are ranking teams based on who they're able to beat rather than who they don't beat when they should beat them. And I think we're doing it the right way. Seeing that the teams that are making it farther have more ranked wins but also have more unranked losses leads me to believe that the unranked losses, one, aren't important to the committee, and two, don't really show the true colors of this team. All these teams are going to slip up at some point. It seems like for some reason the teams that have more success in the tournament slip up more often during the regular season. And maybe it's as simple as everybody's due for those type of losses and those teams get them out of the way in the regular season, while other teams that should be where they are waiting till the tournament to lose the teams that they're not supposed to.
Yeah, you've definitely raised a lot of good points. I kind of agree with you a lot on this. In college football, we see that who you lose to is sometimes more important. Ohio State did not make the college football playoff this year because they had a bad unranked loss to Purdue. Oklahoma's only loss was to Texas. In college basketball, it's how when you have to play the important games, how does it matter? You can lose unranked games. It's okay. The current number one team in the country, Duke, lost to unranked Syracuse. They are number one. They far deserve to be number one. Basketball is such a long season that you have to look at the big picture. You can't just look at one slice of the pie. I looked at also from all 12 number one seeds, what conferences these teams came from. So they only came from five conferences, actually. The ACC, the Big East, the Big 12, the WCC, and the Pac-12. Very interestingly enough, no Big Ten teams in any of the last three seasons have been a number one seed. I found that interesting. The WCC has had only two. Gonzaga, but we've seen kind of the same teams. Villanova has been a number one twice. Virginia has been number one twice. Kansas has been each of the last three seasons, obviously not bringing them success. So it's your conference play kind of also matters as well. In the 2018 season, Virginia was the overall number one seed. Nine teams from the ACC tournament made it. Makes sense. Villanova was the two seed. Six from the Big East made it. Also makes sense. Xavier was the fourth number one seed that year, which also plays in the Big East, and Kansas was the third overall seed. Seven made it from the Big 12, but they had more losses than Villanova. That makes sense. Looking at 2017, Villanova overall number one, Big East once again represented by seven. Kansas of the Big 12 was represented by six. North Carolina of the ACC represented by nine. ACC is obviously bigger than most of these other conferences. We're going to, in general, see more participation from them. Gonzaga, however, 32-1. Great record, 5-0 against top 25, only one unranked loss. Only two teams were represented by the WCC, so they were the fourth number one seed. At only one loss, too, so the conference strength is important to the committee as well. It doesn't matter that Gonzaga went 5-0 against top 25 opponents. It was the fact that their conference was pretty weak and that they had that one unranked loss in it. Remember, a few years back, Wichita State was undefeated, and people were still weary to put them in as the consensus number one. Well, they ended up losing the second round to 8-seeded Kentucky that year, if I remember correctly. So clearly you have to come from a strong conference in order for the committee to put more precedence on you as a team. Another conference, 2016, Oregon came from the Pac-12, was the fourth. Oregon that year is such a weird team to me. So they went 28-6 in regular season, 5-0 against top 25. Great. Six unranked losses. It was really such a big boom or bust team for that Oregon Ducks team that season. Seven teams in the Pac-12 represented that year in March Madness. So clearly the Pac-12 was not bad. Oregon was just such a weird team that year.
Yeah, so certainly the conference that they play in is going to make a difference, because while we are talking about who they beat and who they lose to, there's so much more that goes into that. It's not just the ranked teams that they beat and the unranked teams that they lose to. It's the unranked teams that they beat and the ranked teams that they lose to. It's the conference schedule. It's the overall strength of schedule. And obviously, that's going to vary a lot. We talked about the ACC earlier in the show and how those few teams are competitive every single year. Talk about Gonzaga, and they don't necessarily have that competition on their way to the tournament. So that's going to make a difference as well. But going back a little bit more to the ranked wins versus the unranked losses, just a couple of things that kind of stood out to me. Number one, Virginia going into last year's tournament, top seed overall. They lost in the first round, the first number one seed to do that ever. They only had one unranked loss during the regular season. They really looked like they kind of had it all together, because they had a handful of ranked wins as well. But again, if you're looking at unranked losses and not being that important, I think that's a team that kind of speaks to that. Villanova last year as well, they ended up winning it all. They had four unranked losses throughout the regular season. So two very opposites that had similar success overall in the regular season had very different success come tournament time. Jumping back a few years, in 2017, I found this one interesting. Number two, Duke, beat the number six team, the 8, 10, 14, 15, 20, 21 twice, and 22 throughout their regular season. Four unranked losses, and they end up losing in the round of 32 come the tournament. So they knock off all of those ranked teams, and they put together that fantastic resume just to fall apart in the second round of the tournament. Very interesting team there. Couple from 2016, Oregon, six unranked losses, as you've mentioned a couple times, went to the Elite Eight. Virginia that year had five unranked losses, went to the Elite Eight. So those are some teams that you might not have guessed would have the type of success, but they found a way to anyway. So for me, we break this down, we look at it in depth. For me, it's ranked wins that come first, unranked losses come second.
Yeah, it's definitely who you beat, how strong the team you beat is. You can lose. Don't lose too many if you're going to lose. That was Uncorked for you. We're going to wrap up the show with Quick Picks in quick succession. We are going to start with the National Hockey League. Interesting matchup. Two potential wildcard teams, Colorado Avalanche against the Chicago Blackhawks. I'm going to go Chicago. They've been strong recently. Patrick Kane has been on a tear. Really the only player that can give Nikita Kucherov a run for his money for most points in the league this season, possibly MVP. I'm going to go with the Blackhawks.
I'm going to go with the Blackhawks as well. These are two teams that are tied in the standings right now. Chicago trending upwards, Colorado trending the wrong way. And when we look at scoring, Mika Rantanen was the talk of the league early on. Patrick Kane has surpassed him in points. Patrick Kane is looking like the Patrick Kane of old. I will take the Chicago Blackhawks. The Winnipeg Jets at the Vegas Golden Knights, two teams that aren't playing particularly well, but I'm going to take the Jets. They are 3-3-2 in the month of February, but the Golden Knights have lost 4-5, 8-11, and 10-15. For that reason, I'll take the Jets.
Yeah, teams find some bad stretches all throughout the season. Right now seems to be one for the Golden Knights. I'm going to go with the Jets as well. They seem to be, in my opinion, the stronger team on paper. Knights have not been having as much success. I'm going to go with Winnipeg. Moving into the NBA, a great game coming up this week. The Spurs will be traveling to Toronto to face against Raptors. DeMar DeRozan will be returning to Toronto for the first time since he was traded for Kawhi Leonard. For that reason, I'm going to go with the Spurs. I think DeRozan could potentially put up 40 points in that game. He loved Toronto. He loved playing there. He was heartbroken when he was traded away from the city that he loved playing for. I think he's going to use that to fuel the fire of his game to put the Spurs over the edge in this one.
It is his return. It's going to be an emotional night. However, for me, the Raptors are just a better team. They're on a six-game win streak in their place. I know he's coming back, and it's going to be a lot of different things going on, but I'm going to take the Raptors. Thunder at Nuggets. I'm going to take the Thunder. This is the 2-3 in the Western Conference right now. Denver is kind of a team that's quietly worked their way up. I'll be anxious to see how they handle two stars in Paul George and Russell Westbrook. But Oklahoma City is 8-2 in their last 10, two games back of the Nuggets. This is one that could be big for them, and I think they're going to take it. I'll go Thunder.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Nuggets in this one. I would love to see this 2-3 as the matchup in the second round of the playoffs. I think these two teams are very evenly matched. I think they're both strong teams. I'm going to go with the Nuggets. I just think that the Thunder needed to lose a game at some point. Nuggets are a strong team. I think they can do it. Three college basketball games coming up this week. Some great top 15 matchups. Starting the ACC, number 8, UNC will travel to number 1, Duke. Tickets are going for over 2,000 for this game, Matt. It's going to be a great game. I'm going to go with Duke. I think they are ridiculously strong. I don't think they're going to lose at home in a rivalry game to UNC. I like Duke.
No, I agree with you. They tip off in just a few minutes. I think the defense is going to make the difference for Duke. I will take Duke. Number 10, Michigan State at number 7, Michigan. Two teams not playing well, as we mentioned. Michigan State is 3-3 in their last six. They're both struggling. I'm going to take Michigan. They're at home. I made a bold prediction on them at the beginning of the season. I'll stick with them. I'll go Wolverines.
I gave high praises to Michigan State earlier in the year, and then they started losing a lot. So I think now that we incorporate them back into our show, I think they're going to be able to win. Michigan's been struggling. That loss to Penn State stings. I'm going to go with Michigan State. An SEC matchup, an interesting one. Number 5 Tennessee will be traveling to the Bayou to face off against number 13 LSU. LSU knocked off Kentucky last week. I think they're going to be able to do it again this week. Tennessee's a strong team, but I like LSU in this one.
I'm going to take Tennessee. They just lost to Kentucky. I don't think they're going down again just yet. Statistically, all signs point to Tennessee. I will take the Volunteers.
Most importantly, though, we got some differences in our picks this week. That's what we look forward to.
Yeah, that's right. That's our time. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We will be back at the same time next week. Good night, everyone.